All right, we're going to continue our series in Genesis. So we're looking at chapters 27 and 28. One of the dilemmas in preaching through narrative structure is the clear points from the passage are made over the course of a storyline. Well, there's lots of points you could possibly make. You wouldn't necessarily have the authority of the text on your side when you take every tangent that you could if you break it down into smaller chunks. In the larger flow of thought, you can see ideas that are being communicated. So that forces us to take larger chunks than maybe even you're accustomed to. And so I want to remind you, as I keep doing, the big picture of where Genesis has been going so that we read this in that flow. We've seen that Genesis has an eye for helping us understand our origins, how we got to be where we are now, and what God is doing in the world. You know, so it's shown that we are made with purpose and value, made in God's image with a role to play in this earth. We've also seen in great detail how sin distorts and destroys that. And over we've seen the bondage of sin, the consequences of sin as reoccurring themes. And then from that, one of the big things that Genesis has developed and really hit on is that that God is committed to setting things right, and that he's going to do it through his own faithfulness by grace through faith. And so that's been hit in big picture as we walked from the creation out through Abraham. And now as we've been walking through Isaac and Jacob and Esau, we really haven't left those themes behind. But we're getting very personal looks at how those same truths hit our daily life. And so as we go through this next passage and we look at Jacob and Esau's relationship for another adventure, ultimately, I'm hoping we come away with you seeing that relationship with God is offered by grace and received by faith. And you've heard that over and over. But you're going to see, as we go through this, the ravages of sin all the more, and the brokenness and the hopelessness that comes from that. And yet still in the midst of that, you're going to see how God's grace invades and calls from us faith. And so there's some key things that we'll sort through. But I'm going to go ahead and try and just read through chapter 27, 28. Follow along. I'm reading from the ESV. It flows well, and so I think you can just keep with me here. When Isaac was old, and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old, and I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me, so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock and bring me two good young goats so that I may prepare them from them a delicious food for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it in to your father to eat so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall be seen to be mocking him and bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go bring them to me." So he went and took them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared the delicious food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the young goats she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. And she put the delicious food and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. So he went into his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am." "Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat my game, that your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near, that I may feel you, my son. to know whether you really are my son Esau or not? So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize him, because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him, and he said, Are you really my son Esau? He answered, I am. Then he said, Bring it near to me, that I may eat my son's game and bless you. So he brought it near to him, and he ate. And he brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, Come near and kiss me, my son. So he came near and kissed him, and Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you. As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, then Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. He also prepared delicious food and brought it in to his father, and said to his father, Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me. His father Isaac said to him, Who are you? He answered, I am your son, your firstborn, Esau. Then Isaac trembled very violently and said, Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him. Yes, and he shall be blessed. As soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry, and said to his father, Bless me, even me also, O my father. But he said, Your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing. Esau said, Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. Then he said, Have you not reserved a blessing for me? Isaac answered and said to Esau, Behold, I have made him lord over you, and all his brothers I have given to him for servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son? Esau said to his father, Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of the heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when he grows restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck. Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. But the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, Behold, your brother Esau comforts himself about you by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise, flee to Laban, my brother in Haran, and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away, until your brother's anger turns away from you, and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you from there. Why should I be reft of you both in one day? Then Rebekah said to Isaac, I loathe my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women like these, one of these women of the land, what good will my life be to me? Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and directed him, You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take as your wife from there one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he give the blessing of Abraham to you, to your offspring with you, that you may take possession of the land of your sojournings that God gave to Abraham. Thus Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Padan Aram, to Laban, to the son of Bethuel the Aramean, to the brother of Rebekah, Jacob and Esau's mother. Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram and take a wife from there, and that he blessed him and directed him, You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. And that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Padan Aram. So when Esau saw that the Canaanite women did not please Isaac his father, Esau went to Ishmael and took as his wife, besides the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in the way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. We'll stop there. I know that's a lot. Some of that is probably familiar. You maybe aren't used to putting them all together. But you've got this progression. And it opened really at the end of chapter 26, where it mentioned that Esau had taken Hittite wives and that they made life bitter for Rebekah and Isaac. And so we've had that idea sort of just hanging. And then we walked over and had this side story about the stealing of the blessing. And then we came back to this issue of the wives. And we're still sort of following that trajectory as Jacob's going to go meet his future wives. But in this, you're getting a picture of how Jacob comes to faith. Not news to us to see that the patriarchs are not amazingly righteous people. But you really get a close-up and personal look at just the destructiveness of sin and the brokenness and the dysfunction that it creates and produces in relationships among people. And so you see that as the backdrop to God's gracious revelation of himself to Jacob. And grace becomes more poignant, more profound and wonderful when you understand how far we were from deserving it. It's one thing to say, I don't deserve it. It's another to be personally aware of just how much I don't deserve it. And so we get this storyline, and you see there's dysfunction from day one. Even just in the way Rebecca and Isaac talk about their kids, mom and dad are obviously not together. Isaac seems to be a rather shallow person. Even though God has spoken clearly from their birth over who he has chosen, Isaac just likes the one that gets him good food. Even the picture of him having dim eyes sort of speaks to the spiritual dimness that we're seeing in Isaac at this point in his life. He's not really taking any sort of leadership role in this passage. He's just passively appeasing himself and dealing with stuff. And I do think God is in it to work on Jacob. But it's a very broken system. So he talks of Esau, his son. And when Rebekah talks, it's interesting. She says that Isaac is going to bless his son, Esau. And then she calls Jacob her son. Now, that doesn't work. They're both from her and they're both from him. But you can already tell that the family's not together, that they've each got their favorites and they've got conflicting agendas. And it's not about God and his promise and his faithfulness. It's just a broken, self-serving system. And in a lot of ways, what Isaac's about to get from Jacob is just the climax of a family trait. We saw with Abraham the tendency to lie and manipulate when he thought it served him and lie about his wife, it's my sister. We saw that Isaac did not break out of that rut but continues to be the same type of person when trials are on. He's willing to manipulate, lie, and try and cheat people to make it work. And now comes Jacob, and he just levels it up. He says, okay, I can be like my parents and then some. You want to see lying and manipulating for your own purpose? Watch this. And he just goes the whole way. So you're seeing just generational brokenness climaxing in all of its terrible wonder. When he comes in here, his interactions with his father are debased on multiple levels. I mean, it begins with him admitting that he knows what he's about to do is a mockery of his dad. He says, if I get caught, they'll see it as a mockery and curse me, because he's right. He is mocking his father. Who is this? It's Esau, your firstborn. He knows his dad's favoritism, and he's just playing it with a lie. So it starts with dishonesty, and that's bad enough. But then he moves to blasphemy. Did you catch that? Isaac says, how did you get back so quickly? Jacob says, the Lord your God has given me success. Wow. You're not just lying. You drag God into it. You stick his name on your lie. He's clearly aware of the faith of his father, but it's not his. Did you catch that? He didn't say the Lord my God. It's the Lord your God. Your God, Isaac. And even the language of him giving success borrows from their own history. Remember when Abraham sends his servant to find a wife for Isaac, and he prays that the Lord, the God of Abraham, would give him success? Jacob's using a lot of those very same words. And he's like, yeah, yeah. Like you always told us, Dad. Totally happening. You can tell the flippancy with which he invokes the name of God and invokes the stories of God's faithfulness, that it's not true to Jacob yet. It's just a means for him to get what he wants from his dad. So he starts with lying and mockery. He moves to blasphemy, and then he just seals it up with treachery. At the very end, and this is so poignant, for, you know, most commentaries make a big deal about this. Here is Jacob coming with food. And it notes that not just the meat that was asked, but he brings bread along with it. And so here is with a meal and breaking bread with his dad, and then he kisses him in the midst of his lie. And you talk about a treachery that makes us think forward of the same bitterness that Jesus will taste. This is our sin doing what it does. We will lie as we kiss you. It's personal. I mean, think of Isaac. And if you're going, well, maybe you're blowing this out of proportion. Follow the storyline. What happens to Isaac and to Esau when they realize what happens? They're not just like, wow, that sly dog. It says he shakes and trembles violently. Do you see how profoundly betrayed and hurt and shocked Isaac is? This is a new low. And he's just disturbed. It says he shakes. But you also have this realization coming, because he understands that Jacob was God's chosen, that God was going to bless him. And so even though he didn't know who he was blessing, you might think, well, couldn't he just like, hey, let's do a do-over. I meant to bless Esau anyway. He says, and indeed he shall be blessed. He knows that this is God working through our brokenness to still bring about what God has said he's going to do. Don't get me wrong. I don't think that God needed Jacob to lie and to slander to get his will done. I think if Jacob could have been a faithful person and walked by faith, God would have taken care of it either way. But what I am saying is that our brokenness doesn't stop God from doing what God is going to do. And Isaac sees that when he says, and he will be blessed. He understands what happened here was what was going to happen. But it's still a wretched situation. He's shaking physically. Twice it mentions that Esau cries out and weeps bitterly, weeps violently, weeps loudly. And you just even hear in the dialogue, oh my father, me, even me. I mean, Esau has been fairly callous towards his potential blessing and role most of his life. And it seems like this is the moment where it finally hits him. What all he's lost. There is within this narrative, in some sense, you can see that most of the time Esau doesn't seem to care a ton. Remember, early on, he gives his birthright away for food. He's like, I'm hungry. I don't care. What's my birthright to me? Which shows that he doesn't really devalue it. The text even says, in such he despised his birthright. Even later in our text, it's only after Isaac, recognizing the covenant God has made, asks Jacob to honor that covenant and not marry from the pagan women, and sends him out, that Esau finally goes, oh, so this local marriage thing was a problem. He should have known. It's been an issue all along. If he's paying any attention to what God has promised and what God is doing, this isn't news. It's not news to us walking through Genesis. But you see, first off, that Esau doesn't seem to care, and the only time he cares is when he thinks he might get something out of it. Oh, well, then let me go quick find a wife to appease my parents. And he doesn't even do it well. It's really tragic. The castaway son goes and marries a wife from the other castaway son. He doesn't realize he's actually identifying with his role very well, that he is not the one chosen to receive the promise. But this is Esau, and nonetheless, this is a train wreck of their entire family relationships. Esau doesn't know there's issues with the wives till Isaac talks about it, which gives you a sense that Esau and Rebecca probably aren't even speaking. And even though Rebecca's trying to keep her sons and to get the blessing to Jacob, in the end, she just loses them both. We get this picture of what she says to Isaac. Esau only hears when it comes from Isaac, so we see the brokenness in our relationship with Esau. And to not lose Jacob as well, she has to send him away. He's going to be gone for 20 years, and we will never hear from Rebecca again. Even though she says, just stay till I call you, she never calls. And our next time we hear of her, aside from references and genealogies, is that she's buried. You see the ravages of sin. This relationship, this family is torn apart. The only comfort that Esau has is that maybe he can kill his brother. Jacob swindles to get it all and ends up having to leave it all behind anyway. The birthright that he stole, which would be the double portion of inheriting his father's flocks and things, all stays behind with Esau as Jacob runs. His only request to God is, let me have food and clothing. Gives you the sense he's got nothing. This passage is just replete with irony. What they seek and think they get, they end up losing. And that's on all sides, everybody involved. We've talked before in Genesis. We've said over and over that Genesis shows us, you know, the ravages of sin, its bondage, its brokenness, how it brings death into this. So this isn't new, but this is a lot more personal. This isn't just death painted, you know, big when we look at Noah's day and everyone's violent and messed up. We just hear general statements of, hey, they got issues. Now we're looking and we've stepped inside the tent and we're watching a home that's just broken in its sinfulness. And so that's where this story fits in. Lest you get confused and wonder how Jacob got to be the promised heir and think it's just because Jacob was awesome, Genesis goes out of its way to help you see that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are imperfect people in their bondage to sin. And if they're being saved and if they're being chosen, it's not because they earned it. In fact, what's interesting is we reverse the roles from what you'd expect. So here's Jacob fleeing for his life. Here's Jacob, the liar, the cheat, the swindler. He has had no interest in God up to this point. When he references him, it's blasphemy and attributing it to his father, but not personal. And in his flight, when he has nothing, God comes to him. At this point, if anybody does not deserve God's attention, this guy's on the list. But he lays down, goes to sleep, and he has this vision where there's a ladder or a staircase, depending on your translation, and I don't think it makes any difference, that connects earth and heaven. You see that Jacob understands that because he says, truly, this is the gateway of heaven. He sees that there's a connection being made, and this is so profound in the scope of Genesis, where we've seen the brokenness between God and man. We've seen God and man together in the garden. We've seen the expulsion that comes. And so Jacob gets a vision of how God is bridging what sin has broken, and God's statement over him is the promise that he made to Abraham. He restates it and affirms, what I promised to Abraham is true of you. I am doing this. I am keeping my covenant. And it's painfully clear that this is God's faithfulness, not Jacob's, not Isaac's. Isaac would have blessed the other son in disobedience. Jacob's just stealing it. He doesn't care about God. And yet God says, I will be faithful. And so God gives Jacob a revelation of his grace and this picture of a bridge being made whereby God is communicating with man. You know, prefigures what God is ultimately going to do through that covenant. where God is through His offspring going to bless all men, that He is through Jesus going to bridge heaven and earth and bring them back into communication. And so Jacob gets this glimpse, not just of God speaking what He's been saying He's going to do, but even a picture of what it means. And it knocks his socks off. He wakes up and he's like, I didn't realize that I was in a special place. He's been oblivious to God's presence up till now. He admits that readily. And he goes, he's fearful at the wonder of it, but he responds by making God his God. He responds by getting up and saying, and it's interesting because he's already a different Jacob, and he's about to become much more of a different Jacob as God puts him through some trials to grow him up a bit. But Jacob before was the swindler who tries to see what he could steal and take. Jacob, after a vision of God's grace, gets up and says, if you just, you know, clothe me and feed me and get me home, you're my God. Just be with me. That's not the how much can I get, swindle your birthright, Jacob. This is a Jacob who is finally beginning to humble himself, and he responds to the grace of God, this revelation that he didn't deserve, in faith. He gets up from there and makes a decision, makes a commitment that he actually desires to follow God. And you hear him, he's saying, you know, he puts up this stone, he marks the place and says, I'm going to come back and this is going to be a place of worship. He names the place Beth-El, which Bet is the word for house in Hebrew and El is God, so he's not being very clever here. He's like, he got up and goes, wow, this is the house of God. I will call it the house of God. But he's just overwhelmed. What just happened here? He was busy living his life for his purposes in bondage to sin, just self-centered, self-serving, and God interrupts and knocks him on his can. And he gets up and wonders. And all he can think about is, how am I going to serve this God? How am I going to worship this God? How am I going to... And so he says, if God will be with me, and will keep me in the way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace. All he's saying there is, if God will just do half of what he just promised me, then the Lord, it's all in caps, that's Yahweh, then Yahweh shall be my God. Not Isaac's God anymore, not your God, my God. And this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. I'm going to make this a place of worship. And of all that you give me, I will give a tenth, a full tenth to you. He's like, and understand, tenth hasn't shown up a lot in Scripture. This isn't the Mosaic Law and the tithing. The last time we saw this was when Abraham gave a tenth to Melchizedek in recognition of Melchizedek's priesthood before Almighty God. This is an act of Jacob humbling himself and recognizing that he is now going to be a follower of Yahweh. And that he is going to devote himself to the worship and service of Yahweh. So there's things you take from this. On a basic sense, what I've said here is he's entered into the relationship element. Before this, Yahweh was the stories he heard. He can manipulate them and use them in his conversations with his dad. It was a faith that he knew about, but now it's become a relationship. This God has appeared to him. And part of what he says is, if you'll be with me, I don't just want to know about you and get your blessing. I want you. If you go with me, I'm in. And so a relationship is initiated by God offering grace. God coming to Jacob when Jacob was so lost he wouldn't go to God. And Jacob responds to that grace with faith, with the choice to give himself and entrust himself over to that God. A lot of times we swap that order. We might say that we believe that God's salvation is by grace. But the way we order it in our heads is, so I better step up and do better so that God can give me grace. Which makes grace not grace. If God waits till Jacob grows up and starts acting righteously, this moment may have never happened. It doesn't look likely that Jacob was ever going to become other than what he's just been really good at being, a sinner. But what you see is the power of grace. to change our heart motivations and introduce a possibility that wasn't a possibility before. Up till now, Jacob does not think about serving and following God. He just thinks about Jacob. But when God moves in grace and reveals himself to Jacob anyway, and remains faithful to the covenant anyway, Jacob gets up and voluntarily wants to serve and follow this God. We had a little discussion about this yesterday. We did our car wash, and as a lot of the drama guys will not be shocked, I like to get everybody together after an outreach and just sort of talk, hey, what'd you learn? What'd you see? You know, and we asked questions of what went well, what could go better, where did you see God at work? And I always ask them what made you laugh, which at a car wash, some good answers. But they talked about how interesting it was that we were giving people a free car wash, and that was very intentional on our part. We wanted to tell them, hey, we just want to serve you. We just want to serve our community. We're not trying to get anything out of it. And how many people, in response to that grace act of just, here's a free car wash, wanted to pay us, enough so that they were like adamant, like, no, I want to give you something. One guy actually got out of his car, and as we're watching it, he gets his phone out, and he does that Facebook Live thing and starts broadcasting. He's like, check these guys out. They're doing car washes in the community. This is so awesome. He's like advertising for our church on his friend feed. And we didn't ask him for that. I mean, we love it. But if I walked around our block and said, hey, we're a new church in town, I need you to spread the word, even if they're nicely inclined to us, they probably won't do it. But when he received something graciously from it, he instantly was motivated, just jumped up and did it. And so many people paid us way more than we would ever have dreamed of asking for a car wash. We originally had thought about making it a dollar car wash. We thought then we would trick him and give him a dollar instead of get a dollar, but we're broke, so we just made it free. And we were nervous that a dollar car wash would scare some people away, that they wouldn't stop if it was a buck. But when it was free, we had people, some folks paid us over $20 for their car wash. And they wanted to. They were excited to. They were smiling as they went through their wallet to see what they could come up with. I remember one guy gave me a 20, and he's, are you sure you guys aren't asking anything? He's like, no. I said, we have no financial plans. This is just a gift to the community. I said, we'll probably just use whatever's there to buy pizza for lunch. And he's like, hold on. And goes back in. Apparently the idea of getting his pizza in response to the gift he received excited him. $5 more came out. Grace has a power to enliven where fear alone would not. You would think if you just focus on the consequences of sin, you'd stop doing it, right? We buy that logic. But the consequences of sin were not muted in this family relationship. There, we started the chapter with a screwed up family because of sin, and they were just getting worse. And Jacob was fully prepared to just be isolated from his family indefinitely while he hides from his brother who wants to kill him. And this isn't stopping or changing anybody. And it's amazingly frustrating how we do this. We know our sin is bad. We know our sin has consequences. We're experiencing those consequences, and we do it again. We just keep right on doing it. And then we get in our Christian circles, and we do scare tactics, and we talk about the horrors and hope that that will help you, and all it does is make you walk out the door and feel worse as you do it again, but you still do it again. What we see, this shouldn't shock us. That's the story of Genesis. Sinful people reaping death and keeping sinning. If just knowing this sin was bad could save us, then the covenant's unnecessary. The Messiah's unnecessary. All we needed was a good lecture. But there's something miraculous in the grace of God that it brings life into dead things, which we've seen over and over. And here in Jacob, the first selfless thought goes through his head. This is new. Jacob says, I promise to give. I promise to follow. I don't care if I... Just be with me. That dead heart just beat. And its first gasp was faith. You need, if you want to have victory over sin, you need God. No lecture, no law can free you. But a revelation of who God is in His goodness and His power, and particularly a revelation of heaven that is coming to earth and all the wonder and awesomeness of that, touches something in your heart, something that's been long cold that you were made for, and wells up in a heart of gratitude that wants to do something else. If we just focus on the bad, we just keep doing it. Now we are called to what we were supposed to be. He sees a God worth worshiping, and he does that. Meanwhile, his old self-centeredness is falling off behind. And the Jacob that returns from this little 20-year exodus will be a profoundly different man. I've seen this in my own life, and I feel bad when I reuse illustrations I've told before. The drama kids will all be like, heard it. Because it goes back now about 8 years. but I tell the story of how we got our first iPods in the drama ministry. And this was one of those moments where God moved in grace before I was ready, and then I was mad at him because I knew I didn't deserve it. It's just funny when you preach the gospel every week and you're still having issues with that. But I remember I was praying, and I was having one of those angry prayer sessions with God, and part of it was some honesty that finally crept in, where there's areas of my character where I saw cycles. There were certain areas where my treatment of people, my attitudes, and you know, those kind of reoccurring sins would come around that on a monthly basis. And I just said, you know, God, it seems like I'm always back here saying, I'm sorry, I'll go make it right. But I know me, and I'm going to want to do it again. Give me about a month. And I was just, in that honesty, I was frustrated and overwhelmed. And I remember I had prayed, I said, God, I don't know how to even say I'm sorry because I'm not sure that I am. I don't actually know if I want to get better. I just want to feel better by apologizing. And after I had said that, I just sat there because what else do you say in a prayer when you just admit that you're just playing around anyway? I mean, I was just out of words. I was sitting there in our little drama office, which at the time was about the size of two of these tables. And discouraged. Why am I in ministry if I don't even want to have God change me on anything? And I remember I stood up and was like, I'm just going to go for a walk. I walked over to the door and I opened it. And while I've been sitting there having this wonderfully unholy prayer to God, letting him know that I don't intend to ever grow up spiritually, somebody had snuck up with three brand new iPods to donate to our ministry and set them on the doorstep. Now they're all excited. They're blessing this minister. And I'm in there fighting with God. And I don't realize that as I'm telling him, I don't want you to change me, God, he's blessing me. And I opened the door and I looked down and saw those boxes and I was so mad. And I said, God, you can't bless me right now. And I closed the door and I'm just sitting there like, I want to go for a walk, but if I have to get out the door, I have to get past these iPods. And I don't want to face the reality that in my sin, God is being gracious to me. I want to earn it. In my head, I'm thinking, just let me get over this day. I'll be better tomorrow. We'll go do an outreach. I'll preach the gospel. And I'll feel like I deserve these. And I'll happily take them. But right now, as I had to open that door and pick them up. And it was so frustrating. It was like I didn't want to touch them. I remember carrying them. I'm just staring at them like, is this a dream? Am I going to wake up and they disappear? That would be wonderful right now. Sit them down on my desk. And I sit back in the same chair where I'd been praying miserably in bondage to my sin a moment ago. And as I sit there and look at these dang boxes, I remember saying, I don't want to do it anymore, God. I couldn't get that with any sincerity out of my mouth, not 5 minutes before. But a revelation of a good and gracious God just overwhelmed my heart and broke it. Broke it in a way that no amount of willpower on my side could. I couldn't change me. But God's grace did in a millisecond what a good hour of sitting there rantily praying could not do. And with ease and joy, I began to pray, God, I'm actually sorry. And if you want to show me things, steps I should be taking, I don't even care what they are. I'm in. I'll go where you want me to go. I'll do what you want. If I need to go talk to some people and be humbled and humiliated and make any, I'm in. I want to do whatever. I'm in. I knew that was the right answer before. I just knew that I wouldn't mean it before and wouldn't do it. I can't save me. You can't save you. Genesis has hit that point, but now it got real personal and looked at real people in all their family brokenness. I don't know what your dysfunction in your family is, but y'all got it because y'all sinners. And I don't know if you're even interested in seeing those things change or if you're just at that point where like, this is just who I am. People just need to learn to deal with me, but I am done working on it. And in a sense, you're right. You need to be done working on it. But you need to see who you are in all of its brokenness in light of who God is, and allow an encounter with God to change your heart. That's why we gather and we sing and we read the scriptures. You're not looking for an encounter with Tim or with Nate or with Chad. We're just hoping that in the midst of this, the church gathered functions like a temple where we get this little porthole that opens and a glimpse of God in His glory and of heaven in its wonder. And as the mist fades and we realize that in its fullness, that's still going to come someday down the road. That encounter allows us to get up and go out that door and have a heart that's beating afresh and wants to live differently. Not to earn God's favor, but an overwhelmed response to it. We have a God who in His graciousness desires to save and to redeem. And He just wants to break in and interrupt your life pattern of sin so that you can turn to Him and be saved. That's the heart of the Genesis narrative, and that's what we're seeing is Jacob's moment, where he goes from a kid who grew up in a Christian home and went to Sunday school but was depraved like the rest of us, to when God interrupted him and it got real. I think most kids that grow up in church need to have that moment where the faith they heard about becomes a faith that has enlivened them. Where the God that was your God, Dad, becomes my God. I want to give you just a little time to think on that. It's not really a great discussion. It's a lot more personal this week. So I will take questions after we sing our songs. But I just want you, I've got a couple questions up here to think on. And you can make up your own, that's fine. But what we're saying is that your past cannot separate you from the relationship God is offering. He doesn't offer it because you're awesome. He offers it because He's awesome. So the question is just, have you accepted His forgiveness for past offenses? Are you still holding that list? Or have you turned and just beheld Him? The relationship offered is an invitation to make Him your God and to follow Him in total trust. Have you entrusted your life into His hands? When you see God as He is, that's a no-brainer. If you're struggling with trusting Him, you need to get your eyes lifted back up and remember who you're thinking about and trusting yourself to. Because when you see Him as He is, it's just the most natural response. So I want to give you some time just to pray, chat with God, reflect on His grace. I'm going to sing the song El Shaddai. We'll have the lyrics up on the screen. Some of the words are Hebrew, so if you don't understand them, that's fine. I don't know any of you to be native Hebrew speakers. El Shaddai is one of the phrases that showed up in our passage. It means God Almighty. You heard that when He was talking. It's also the word that was used most notably when God gave the sign of the covenant back when they were circumcised. He says, this is what God Almighty was promised. The mighty God by His strength will do it. El Shaddai. El Eliona Adonai speaks to praising, I think if I got it right, praising the Lord. Adonai is Lord. Erkam Kana Adonai is the second line there. I will love you, my Lord, or O Lord. So God Almighty, the great God, or I praise the Lord, and I love you, Lord, are the Hebrew phrases. But the song just walks through a lot of what we have heard and certainly will be hearing in Genesis and reflects on this being the God of Genesis, the God who saves, the God who saves by His might, the God who comes to us in Jesus. And so as I sing it, you can listen if that helps you focus and reflect on God's goodness and grace, or you can totally tune me out if you got your own things that are already queued up that you and Him need to chat about.
Praise and lift you high, El Shaddai.
You saved the son of Abraham through the power of your hand. You turned the sea into dry land. To the outcast on her knees, you were the God who really sees. And by your might, you set your children free. El Shaddai, El Shaddai, El Elyon Adonai. Age to age, you're still the same. By the power of the name, El Shaddai, El Shaddai, El Kamkama Adonai. I will praise and lift you high, El Shaddai. Through the years, you made it clear that the time of Christ was near. Though the people couldn't see what Messiah ought to be, though your word contained the plan, they just could not understand. Your most awesome work was done through the frailty of your son. El Shaddai, El Shaddai, El Elyon Adonai. Age to age, you're still the same. By the power of the name, El Shaddai, El Shaddai, El Kankana Adonai. I will praise you till I die, El Shaddai. Sing that chorus together as best you can. El Shaddai, El Shaddai, El Elyon Adonai. Age to age, you're still the same.